Hey everybody, this is Jim David, and very happy Gay Pride to those who celebrate that thing. This is a really big deal this year for me. This is the first time that my marriage has been legal in the eyes of the federal government, so I'm just as married as my mama and my daddy. Actually, I was talking to my mother, and I said, "Mama, I'm just as married as you." She said, "No, you're not. Talk to me in 60 years. But anyway, it's a really cool thing, and marriage equality just became the law in California. I mean, it's all happening so fast it's giving you a whiplash. But anyway, I thought it'd be fun to have a fellow married man on the show today. The piano that you're listening to right now is the great Joanne Castle, the ragtime pianist from the Lawrence Welk show, who I grew to love when I was a little boy. Remember her? You know, with the big blonde hair and the boobs and everything? Anyway, today I get to talk to one of my favorite piano players of today. He's one of the best piano bar entertainers in New York and one of the most well-known. His name is Brian Nash. He just got through being the musical director for Silence the Musical, which is the musical version of Silence of the Lambs. And you can see him every weekend at the Duplex here in New York, and you can also see him every Tuesday at Therapy, where he accompanies this insanely talented woman named Natalie Joy Johnson. And we talk about a lot of things. He's just hilarious, and he's somebody that I wanted to introduce you to. He's not the type of person that usually does an interview, like all of the other people I've been able to talk to. You know, he was like, "Really? You want to talk to me?" But yeah, I do. So enjoy this interview with Brian Nash, and have a very happy Pride, or not, wherever you are.
The one thing my mother said that turned out to be true was, if you don't practice your piano, you're going to regret it. And she was absolutely correct.
Well, I never practiced the piano.
You didn't?
No.
How did you get to be so good if you never practiced the piano?
I taught myself. I just wanted to learn. I actually just wanted to learn Tori Amos songs when I first heard her in high school. Like, that was it. And I was like, oh, I should start playing the piano now. So I went down to the practice rooms in Interlochen, and then I started teaching myself.
Where's Interlochen again?
Northern Michigan.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, top of the...
It's the Interlochen Arts Academy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were a music major?
I was an opera major.
What?
Opera performance.
You mean to sing?
Yeah, yeah. I majored in that in college, too.
I didn't see my first opera till I met Dan.
Really?
Yeah. I tell Dan that I saved him from a life of having a studio apartment at Lincoln Center with nothing but records on the wall, or scores, because that's what he would have been.
You've saved him from the Lisbon Traviata.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. Good. Exactly. It's helpful.
But what happened to your opera singing career if you didn't... I mean, if you were an opera performance major, and now you're a pianist and a musical director, right?
Yeah. Well, basically, first and foremost, an opera career doesn't happen until you're 30, and I was not about to wait. So when I initially was...
Why doesn't it happen until you're 30?
Because the voice isn't fully mature. And, you know, you go out and you do, like, some random regional stuff. But, you know, you're normally in a young artist program until you're 30, until everything's kind of settled and ossified in your throat. And then you can start actually doing it. Because otherwise you just, like, you know, shred your throat trying to holler out Wagner over a, you know, 70-piece orchestra when you're not ready.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But, like, so I was living in Boston, which is where I went to school. And, you know, I had my degree in opera. And then I was studying record production at Berkeley. Because, I mean, I refused to just do one thing, which is probably, you know, not good. But in the long term, it's been good. But, you know, I was not just going to stay and study my classical music and do that thing. So I was playing in a rock band.
Piano. Keyboards?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was playing and producing and doing string arrangements for that while still studying opera, while studying record production, while playing in a piano bar and doing musical theater regionally in Boston.
So all of that at the same time.
All of that at the same time. And teaching music, for which I was entirely, like, you know, it was at a Catholic school in Dorchester, Massachusetts. So I didn't have to be certified at all, which was glorious. So I was teaching pre-kindergarten through 8th grade music at this Catholic school, which was insane because half the kids didn't speak English because Dorchester was heavily Vietnamese for no real reason. So, like, when I was teaching the ABC song to the pre-kindergartners, I was actually teaching them the language, which was fun.
You mean now I've learned my ABCs? Yeah, yeah. Really? Tell me what you think of me. Oh,
exactly.
No.
And I would. And there's this little girl, Tao, who'd be like, I want to sing ABC by myself. And, you know, she'd sing the ABCs by herself, standing and just like get everybody else to shut up. She was fantastic. So I was doing all that at once. And like I was going to stay in Boston, get my equity card, like finish up the theater thing, and then move to New York so I could audition for theater when I came to New York. And then the rock band got this show, kind of, that was a modern dance choreographer, Skip Costa, was choreographing Rock Stars NYC. And it would be like live bands on stage playing their original stuff while modern dancers would be dancing on the floor. And this was at Show World, the strip club.
The strip club, the former strip club.
Which had become a strip club about a week and a half before. So it still smelled like pussy and fear. I mean, it was just awful. Like, the poles were still in, half of it. They just kind of, like, you know, took off some of the neon.
I never had gone in there. I never went in Show World when it was a porn palace.
Oh,
but didn't it have, like, booths that you would go into and look at the strippers while they were stripping in the middle, and, like, you were staring on the side and, like, masturbating?
Yes.
Gross. Yes.
And this is where we had our first big break. So after that, the lead singer of our band, Justin Tranter, who is now the lead singer of a band called Semi-Precious Weapons, they opened for Gaga. He fired the rest of us, you know, 4 years after we moved to New York. But he decided to, you know, okay, the band is moving to New York. So everybody, let's go. So I moved. I moved in 2002. Got a job waiting tables at EJ's Luncheonette on 6th Avenue and started doing piano bar here.
A Luncheonette?
EJ's Luncheonette. Yeah. Yeah, it was magical. An old man threw bacon at me because it wasn't crisp enough. These things happen.
We'll be here all night with my stories.
Oh, seriously.
With my stories of being a waiter.
Seriously. It's a nightmare. And
I had a lady whose hair caught on fire. I included that. You remember the part in You'll Be Swell, the restaurant scenes?
Yeah.
Well, those are right from my experience working at Beefsteak Charlie's.
You worked at Beefsteak Charlie's?
Broadway and 51st, yes.
Fancy.
For 4 years, I worked. The first 4 years I lived in New York, I worked at Beefsteak Charlie's. And, you know, that was the lady that... Except the one of the stories that didn't make it into the book was there was this, like, middle-aged black couple sitting at a deuce at a table, the two of them. And the husband's head was on the table, like, on the table. And the lady said to me, "Waiter, my husband's dead. I'll take the check." I'm not kidding. I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "He wasn't feeling good anyway. And I really don't know if he's dead, but we had to call the paramedics and they took him out." As they pulled him out on the stretcher, the manager said to me, "Now what did you do?"
Well, at least she asked for the check.
I mean, know.
She wasn't going to walk on the check. I mean, maybe she knew she was getting the life insurance settlement, so she could afford it. I mean...
So then what happened while you were working at EJ's Luncheonette?
Well, I was working at EJ's Luncheonette. I mean, the band was still playing, and we were, like, kind of doing that thing. And the interesting thing is, like, 9-10 years later, Silence, which is the show that I'm conducting, is in what used to be Show World.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm now in the same corner where the dead hooker was found in 91, conducting a show in the same place where I played my first magical show in New York. It's all full circle.
And you're conducting a show that has the song,
If I Could Smell Her Cunt. Which I could when I first walked into that space 10 years ago. I can smell plenty of cunt. Far too much.
You've broken new ground on the podcast.
Exactly.
This is the first time we've ever talked about smelly cunts.
Well, you know, it's good to broaden one's horizon.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's magic.
But did you sort of give up your opera interest?
No, I mean, I was always still singing and I was always still studying it, but it just seemed like that career path was so, like, you have to be in it. You have to be doing it or you're not doing it. Because everybody else that I went to school with, they were, like, office day job and then, like, just studying their scores and going to their teachers and studying and, like, applying for young artist programs. And I had too much other stuff going on.
Right.
Like, I was... You know, about 6 months after I started working at the Luncheonette, I got my first piano bar shift in New York, which I'd been doing that in Boston. And then, like, I eventually got enough piano bar work that I could stop waiting tables.
So where was the piano bar shift?
First piano bar shift was at Duplex. It was Sunday nights at the Duplex, which I'm still playing.
Yeah?
So the first one was Oscar night of 2003.
Did you know enough Broadway stuff by now to do that?
Well, that's a weird...
Or enough tunes?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it was a lot longer than a shift in Boston, because in Boston you play from 9 to 1. In New York you play 9 to 4.
Are you serious?
9 to 4.
You play. Do you take breaks?
I generally take one break at about 1 in the morning.
But you play straight for 4 hours?
Yeah.
Singing?
Yes.
Just you?
Yeah. Well, and you know, like, the waitress will get up and do a couple numbers, and then the bartender will get up and do a couple numbers. But that's like, so it's like 40 minutes of me, and then they get up and do like a 15-minute set, and then I do the next, you know, 45 minutes, and then they come up and do 15 minutes. Like, so it's pretty straight. I did the math once. I sing, on average, 65 songs a night.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
65 songs.
Yeah.
And do you go in there prepared and
no.
say, this is what I'm going to sing?
No, I mean, I generally have, like, you know, a similar thing. Like, there's a path that I kind of warm up with to kind of get in it. But then after that, it's just kind of whatever people are asking for. And I'm just watching the room and reading the room and, like, basically doing a, you know, group psychological profile of who's in the room and what they would like.
I don't know how you do it for 8 hours, because when you sing, you're very intense.
Yes.
You don't just sort of sit there and croon,
no.
you know, quietly.
You can't.
You know, you don't just sit there and go, it's very clear. I mean, you're going, it's very... You're Ethel Merman behind the piano.
That's...
You know?
I think that's the first time I've heard that, but I'll take it.
No, but you're in it. You're like...
Yeah.
Singing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, thank God I have the vocal training that I do, because otherwise, like, it would be a disaster. I would not be able to get through it. And even then, it's like... Now my body is so accustomed to it that I can go in and do 7 hours and be fine. Like, I'm a little vocally tired the next day, but it's not like, like, that sounded like something else entirely.
Do you
that
drink alcohol when you do it?
No.
Never?
No. I don't drink at all.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah.
Yeah. For any reason?
No. Ever. No. No, I just never started.
But when did you start doing musical theater in New York?
Pretty quick after I got here. Like, I...
Well, let me just say something else.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's a lot of work for somebody who does what you do? I mean, because...
It depends. Because, I mean, there's...
Because you're good at it and you have a reputation.
Yeah, but there's, like... It depends on, you know, which aspect of, you know, do what you do. Because I do so many random-ass things. Like, piano bar work, I thought I would never be able to get piano bar work in New York. Like, ever. Because it just seemed like such a thing. And like, you know, 21-year-old kid who, you know, been illegally doing it in Boston for 2 years, like, coming here, I thought, okay, I'll never be able to get a job because so many people do this. And then I started going around to the clubs and I'm like, oh no, 7 people do this. It was the same 7 people working at every club in town.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that floored me. And I was like, okay, this might be something different than I'm thinking of. And, you know, the piano bars changed drastically. I mean, I started doing a night at 54 Below that they wanted to be a traditional piano bar, New York piano bar night, which is, first of all, the people booking it are, you know, just out of college, so they don't know what a traditional piano bar in New York is like, and it doesn't exist anymore. Like, if you think of New York piano bar, you're thinking of, like, Don't Tell Mama in the early mid-80s. Where you'd have brilliant players like, you know, Dick Gallagher behind the keys and Bobby Pico, I mean, who's been there forever and he's unreal. But people who, like, are brilliant pianists and you're not there for their vocals and they're, you know, you're singing show tunes around a piano. And now if you do a show tune in a piano bar in New York, it's like, what the hell is this?
People really?
Occasionally ask for it.
I thought that's all it was show tunes.
Never. Never. It's entirely pop music. Like, you know, people ask for Gaga. People ask for...
They want you to play Lady Gaga in a piano bar.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, because, you know, my good friend Natalie Douglas, who worked in the clubs for 20 years, and I talk about it a lot, and the people who wanted that experience, the... go into a room and listen to standards and chat and have cocktails and have some cigarettes and, you know, surreptitiously pick somebody up, but mainly listen to standards and show tunes. That entire clientele died off.
They did.
Yeah. I mean, you lost everyone who was doing that in the 80s.
You mean from AIDS?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so the clubs had to kind of reinvent themselves. And at the same time that that was happening, they were losing everyone who wanted to do that, and half the people who worked there, and the pianists. I mean, we lost so many brilliant musicians that way. At the same time, karaoke was becoming a thing. So then the straight people would show up in the rooms and want to sing...
Karaoke is the Japanese revenge for Hiroshima.
Exactly. Exactly. You know...
I can't
bear. We thought we got them. Oh, but no. When I started playing at Brandy's, and a lot of, you know, people who were taking a cabaret class would, like, go to the, you know, one of their assignments was to go to piano bars and try out your new material.
A cabaret class?
Yeah. There are cabaret classes.
Like private?
Yeah.
Like acting classes?
Yeah.
There are cabaret classes.
Yes. Teaching the housewives of Long Island, who used to sing in chorus, and now the kids have moved out of the house, and now they want to achieve their dreams, how to put on a cabaret. And there was a Japanese woman who came into Brandy's on the Upper East Side who was, for weeks, was trying out her new number, which was the trolley song. And it was literally, crang, crang, crang went the trolley, ding, ding, ding went the bell, and it was, we were on the floor.
That's all
it
was, can do.
Oh, God, it makes me so happy. Which, okay, I'm telling this story. I should not tell this story.
Of course you should.
You might have to edit it out. This is the tale of Foot Smoke. And Foot Smoke was a man who would come into the bar in Boston. And he...
Foot Smoke?
Foot Smoke. We called him Foot Smoke. Because he had no arms. He had no arms, and he would sit at the bar smoking with his foot.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was no arm on the left side, just kind of like off of the shoulder, and it was like kind of concave on the right shoulder. And he was the gayest man I've ever met in my life. And he had a weird Prince Valiant, like, pudding bowl haircut. God. And he'd sit at the bar, and he'd have his purse slung over his shoulder, and he'd smoke with his foot and drink his cocktail with his foot. Foot Smoke would like to sing sometimes, but he only sang one song. He would get up to the microphone and sing Embraceable You, which is weird enough.
It's hard to sing with a lisp.
It's hard to sing with a lisp.
My sweet embraceable.
My sweet embraceable you. But remember top, like, second line, second verse. I love all the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms around you. Which he doesn't have arms! So, that really just, like, begs the question. So I really just wanted to name it. Above all, I want my arms. And that's it. Like, I wanted that to happen, and I couldn't get through it. I was always, like, ducking behind the piano for it. And then Foot Smoke, you know, showed up at a friend's work and asked if they sold Cartier watches, which I guess for his ankle. Like, he was an enigma.
It can only be true.
It was insane. It was insane. It made me so happy. Also, it makes me feel really bad about myself that I thought that was so fucking hilarious. I want my arms. Really? Really? Pick another song, Queen. Jesus Christ. There are hundreds of years of music to choose from. Pick the one that
you
doesn't...
You have to pick a song. The one song, I Want My Arms
yes.
Around You.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Horrifying.
So. How did you get involved with Silence? Because you're one of the producers of Silence,
yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Silence, I mean, it's lovely because it's been, we actually just posted closing, which is sad. But, you know, it was supposed to be running for 8 weeks and it's been running for 2 years. So I'll take it. Silence started it was like winter of 2004. Someone sent me a website that these two brothers, John and Al Kaplan, had written a bunch of songs for like a mock version of a musical version of Silence of the Lambs. And someone sent it to me because they know I'm a sick fuck and I would enjoy such things. And there were like seven or eight songs online that they just kind of written and put up there.
And they recorded them.
Yeah. Yeah. They recorded themselves. They were film scoring guys, like majors, I think at UCLA.
Because I remember getting, somebody sent me a link.
Yeah.
To put the fucking lotion in the basket.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That song.
Yeah, it was.
And I just thought, this is the sickest thing I've it's so funny and it's so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how dare they make a musical of Silence of the Lambs? And this is either going to be the greatest thing ever, yeah, or it's just going to be horrible.
Yeah. It was kind of getting passed around like crazy, like around the theater community.
Yeah, it was like cultish.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, you know, one of those first, like, real musical theater internet memes.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it was like 2003, 2000. I think they wrote them in 2003, 2004. And I was like, this has to be something. Like, are they doing anything? So I emailed the composers. I was like, is anything happening with this? Are you actually, is this an actual show? And they wrote back, they're like, no, it's just like, we just thought it'd be funny to write songs. We just love the movie. And I wrote back, I'm like, do you mind if I try to do something with this? And they said, fine, yeah. I mean, other people have asked about it, but nothing's really happened. My friend Mark Hartman and I got together with our friend John and started trying to put it together for the New York Fringe Festival.
But did it have a script at this point?
It had no script.
It just had seven songs.
Just had these songs.
These songs.
That they'd put up. They kind of like mocked up a kind of Zucker Brothers kind of like Airplane-esque script for it, the guys who wrote the score. And they sent that along. We had that, and we had the CD of the songs. And we used that to apply to the 2005 Fringe Festival.
And they accepted you.
They accepted
And then all of a sudden you had to write a show.
We had to put a show together.
Yeah, that's right. Because they'll accept half-done stuff.
Oh, yeah, and there was nothing more half-done than this. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't exist. And this was like 2 years after Urinetown had played the Fringe. And then moved on to Broadway. So suddenly the Fringe Festival was a lot fancier than it had been. And they gave us the Lucille Lortel Theater, which has 325 seats, which I think 325. It's a
that's
little
the
over
biggest. That's one of the biggest venues of that whole festival.
It is
if they the, give you that,
it is the biggest.
Well, if they give you that, they obviously think that this is going to do something.
Yep. And we had no script. We got in touch with Hunter Bell, who wrote Title of Show, which played on Broadway more recently. And we thought it was hilarious, and so we asked him on to write the book. And we got Christopher Catelli, brilliant choreographer, had choreographed at that point Bat Boy, and stuff like that, but had recently directed an Actors Fund benefit of Hair at the New Amsterdam. And that was kind of like his first like real directing thing, if he would consider directing and choreographing. And he had been obsessed with the website and jumped on it. So then we had, you know, new fancy director, and we had somebody, you know, actually writing a book, and it came together so quick and so easily. We sold out every performance before we opened, and then added performances, and they sold out before we opened.
Sure.
It was insane. I think it's still the highest grossing Fringe show in history. Like, it outsold Urinetown by a decent amount.
So it's something that just started as kind of a goof.
Yeah, sitting in my car outside of Birdland, playing it for my friends, being like, this is hilarious, what do you think? And then, all of a sudden, it's, like, become an actual thing. And the cast was unbelievable. We, like, the funniest people in the world walked into that audition room, and, like, we're killing it. Jen Harris, who played Clarice originally, it was the funniest audition I've ever seen. She, like, burst into the room, and, like, kicked down the door at Ripley Greer and was like, doing like the wandering around the well scene. And she had just the dialogue of, you know, Catherine, FBI, you're safe. And that was it. But she did like 10 minutes of like running around the basement in the blackout, like, it was insane.
But she did it just like Jodie Foster.
Yeah, Jodie Foster plus about 15% of commentary. And it was just enough and unbelievable. Our original Hannibal Lecter was Paul Kandel.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Tony nominated for Uncle Ernie and Tommy. But our original off-Broadway Hannibal Lecter was Brent Barrett, who was brilliant, just like the most delicious voice. And to hear him sing If I Could Smell Her Cunt, well, you can go hear it on iTunes, it just makes it so much more beautiful. Also hilarious. Because it's
what I couldn't believe was when he sings If I Could Smell Her Cunt, and then they do the pas de deux.
Of course.
And the legs are spread, and her vagina is right in the actor's face.
There's a dream ballet.
It's a dream ballet. And the, you know what, though? It sounds, to some of the people who are listening, mm-hmm. this sounds like trash,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds really filthy. It's not. It's, I mean, it's not any dirtier than the actual movie was.
No.
And it has such good humor in it, and it's such a, it's just such a goof.
Yeah.
That you're laughing all the way through, and you laugh it when the mm-hmm. when the Clarice character turns around and just looks funny because mm-hmm. you're like, that looks just like Jodie Foster.
Yeah, it's everything. Every moment in it is based in the film. I mean, even If I Could Smell Her Cunt is directly from Multiple Migs Line. And the concept that Chris Catelli had, which was so brilliant, was that these people are, you know, a group of really bad, like West Virginian summer stock actors who just decided to try to make their favorite movie a musical. And all of it is just musical theater archetypes. Are You About a Size 14? Of course they turn it into an Oklahoma-esque hoedown. Everything is taken directly from the movie and just done in a musical theater way, as if the stupidest people alive tried really hard to make Silence of the Lambs a good musical and just
hilarious.
Can't.
So where did you meet Brian, your husband?
I actually met him at Duplex.
He was a customer?
Yeah. He would come in and see me play every once in a while. Like, he wasn't like a regular. I think the first time he ever came to see me play was actually on Halloween, and I was dressed up as Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror Picture Show.
In the drag.
Yeah.
In that Frankenfurter.
I think we realized that later.
Tim Curry Frankenfurter drag.
Yeah. Because I used to do Frank at the movie theater by my house outside Chicago.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
You went to see the Rocky Horror movie picture show and dressed up. You were one of those.
I would perform as Frank.
You were a...
Yeah.
Oh, my...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can I just say something? I don't get it. Because I saw the movie.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was fun for what it was. It's sort of campy trash.
Yeah.
I don't really get what the show is about.
No, it's not about anything.
But it's like, I don't understand the cult following that had the people dressing as the characters and coming back again and again and again. It was just, I guess it was just a young people's group thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's like now. I mean, I know it's still happening, but...
It can't be. It was just huge.
It was huge. And I mean, even, you know, when I was going to go see it, like 94, 95, 95, 96, really... like, it was still huge, and that was kind of a way to, you know, kind of embrace, kind of alternative sexuality.
Right.
And, you know, it was kind of that, and, like, a lot of kids were into it.
Yeah.
Because, A, it's filthy, B, it's funny, and C, it's kind of like, you know,
and the music is really good.
It's great.
I got the, London cast album
mm-hmm.
before I... You know, and I listened to it, and it was, I really was, thought the songs were great.
It's a great score.
Yeah.
It really is. And I think it's a lot of...
But when I finally saw it, I went, I don't get it, you know?
Well, not half the fun was being able to...
maybe I was
talk
just
back.
Stupid. Yes. So it's, I see you shiver with Antissa.
Say it!
Patient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
like,
okay.
How imaginative can you get? There are set lines that you have. Like, it was really about figuring out how imaginative you could be with lines that weren't in the standard rep. And you shall have it.
So
in abundance. 2, 3. Hey, Frank, what's your favorite high-protein drink? Come, it's time for the flow show. Like, those kind of moments. If you time it out right, it's perfect. If you fuck it up, you're, you know, it's awful.
And where did you get married?
We got married in Princeton, actually.
New Jersey?
Yeah.
But it wasn't legal.
No, I mean, we did, like, you know, we signed the paperwork in New York. But it had, like, the ceremony in Jersey.
So you got married after it was legal in New York?
Yeah, actually the ceremony was after the New York law had passed.
Oh, okay, so...
Yeah, so we basically, like, you know, did the ceremony, drove over the GW Bridge and signed it.
Did you feel different on your wedding night like
absolutely.
I did?
Absolutely.
Why? Because you had made the vows.
Yes.
That's why.
Yeah.
When you stand in front of... I mean, you were at our wedding.
Yeah.
And it was different from that second.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we just stood in front of a room full of people and swore we're going to be together for the rest of their life. And I wish... And I was talking to Chris Sieber about this.
Yeah.
It's not gay marriage. It's marriage.
No, it's just marriage.
It's just marriage.
Yeah.
That's it.
There's absolutely no difference between... you know, my relationship with my husband and my sister's relationship with her husband. I mean, there's really
it could
not.
Be better.
I don't want to say I don't really know their life, but I don't know your business.
I don't know your business.
But so
you are at Therapy in New York, which mm-hmm. is a bar mm-hmm. in Hell's Kitchen, yep. every Tuesday with the incredible Natalie Joy Johnson. Explain her.
How does one explain Natalie Joy Johnson? Michael Musto, now formerly of the Village Voice,
right, and also an icon. He's a Jim Davis icon.
Yes,
I did talk to Michael.
Unbelievable, brilliant. Called her a cross between Bette Midler and Courtney Love.
I can see it.
Yeah, she was on Broadway in Legally Blonde. Has done a lot of musical theater and has this huge kind of merman-esque voice.
And she's pretty too.
She's gorgeous.
She looks like, you know who she looks like? Hmm. She looks like she should with the blonde wig.
Yeah.
She looks like somebody from the 30s.
Yeah.
It's got like a chorus member of 42nd Street
yeah.
or Alice Faye or somebody.
Yes. I mean, and she's, you know, there's a generous heaping helping of Dorothy Loudon.
Yeah.
In her. But we get to do a new show every week, which is a brilliant playground.
And I don't know how you do it in there because half the bar is not listening. They're all talking.
It's weird. Over the last like 6 months though, they've gotten really attentive and it's gotten really full of people who are coming to see it. And we've been doing it now for 2 years, which is hilarious. Our codependent Tuesdays, as they're dubbed. But it's great because the persona that, you know, her onstage persona is kind of, the backstory is kind of like, you know, faded, you know, slightly faded, you know, grand dame of the stage who is, you know, trying to pizzazz up her act with new material.
And who gets drunk on a bottle of champagne
exactly.
every show.
Who just has, you know, champagne, she's having a fantastic time. Like, it's very, you know, which is
I think
hilarious.
She's brilliant.
It's brilliant, but we get to do...
And when you're performing, you play off of each other, mm-hmm. like you speak each other's language. And
yeah.
You finish each other's sentences.
Yeah, I mean, there's slightly a, you know, it's kind of Kiki and Herb with more musical theater references. Like, just kind of a musical theater bent.
Because mm-hmm.
She's like this kind of fabulous, slightly tragic, slightly wasted, slightly messy, big-voiced dame. And I'm, you know, musically spotting. I'm kind of got one hand on either side of her, steering her in the right direction. But
it's a great show, though.
It's fun, but we get to do stuff like, you know, we'll take a Paula Abdul song, and we will do. She'll want to do Straight Up, you know, because that's, you know, that sounds like a fun tune. And then I'll be like, yes, we can totally do Straight Up, but only if we arrange it like Mein Herr from Cabaret. And so I'm like, boom, Straight Up, now tell me, do you really want to love me forever? Oh, ho, ho, it's insane. And she's like, we do a lot of that kind of reinvention of stuff in kind of a musical theater way. Raise Your Glass by Pink is our closing number. Only it's over the Maybe This Time vamp, and then it goes into Rose's turn at the end. Because that's what this character's kind of musical frame of reference is. It's like when you'd watch the old variety shows, like the Goldie Liza one, and she's doing Bad Girls, but it all sounds like, you know, disco-y Candor and Ebb.
There's this whole feeling when you see a performer like you guys. We're in this alternate universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's this whole other world that has very little to do with the real world out there. It's like, let's have a couple of cocktails and sing these ridiculous songs.
Yeah.
And be happy.
Yeah.
And get into the music. It's really cool.
It's kind of trying to reinvent, I mean, God knows I wasn't there, but like kind of trying to invent that Bet at the Baths, at the Continental Baths vibe. You know, where we're all like hanging out and drinking and there's this fabulous girl in the corner doing some crazy shit and it's just fun. And then we kind of use that vibe when she does like her solo like shows. We're doing one at the New York Musical Theater Festival called Natalie Joy Johnson Full Bush in 3 weeks.
Full Bush?
Full Bush.
I really think you're fabulous at what you do.
Oh,
and
thanks.
You're always a pleasure to see, and people in New York ought to see you. They can see you at the Duplex on Sundays, and they can see you on Tuesdays at Therapy.
Yep, Fridays and Sundays at Duplex. Friday is late night, starting at 11:30, and then Sundays is 9 o'clock on.
Do you think you'll be doing Piano Bar for the rest of your life, probably?
I hope not.
Really?
I love it. It's just exhausting as hell.
Sure.
And, you know, it's fun, and I like having, like, a foot in there. And it's fun, you know, because then I still get to perform. Mm-hmm. I'm not just like in the pit conducting. I'll do it, you know, for as long as I, you know, need to and as long as I can. And, you know, I'll always do like out of town stuff.
Well, thanks, Brian.
Oh, sure.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks. Well, it's always a joy.
And thanks to Brian for playing piano at my wedding last year. I forgot to mention that. I just casually asked him. I mean, he's like one of the top guys in New York. And I just casually said, could you play piano at our wedding ceremony? And he said, absolutely. When and where? So he's a really great guy. And once again, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, so you'll get it delivered into your iTunes automatically whenever I put one up, which is about every 2 weeks. If you just go to the iTunes store and type in Jim David's Icons and hit subscribe, there you are. That's it. So anyway, again, happy Pride, everybody. Nice work to all the people that worked hard to make this happen. This is a really, really big deal. And the conservatives are having a fit, but you know what? Let them. They have a fit about everything. This is just the outrage du jour. So, bye-bye, everybody.